Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently.
Lucas Delraby is a lawyer called to the bar in Ontario and an established and enthusiastic advocate for access to justice and equity, diversity, and inclusion in the legal profession. During his time at Osgoode Hall, Lucas was heavily involved in the Community and Legal Aid Services Program, otherwise known as CLASP, as a caseworker, division leader, and student board member, and with Pro Bono Students Canada, otherwise known as PBSC, as a program coordinator for the Osgoode chapter and national coordinator at PBSC's national office. During his time with PBSC, Lucas assisted in founding the PBSC Trans ID Clinic in Toronto, which has since been replicated across Canada. In Canada's first pro bono tax law clinic, a collaborative initiative including both CLASP and PBSC. Lucas continues to be an active supporter of both CLASP as an alumni board member and PBSC. During his time with BLG, Lucas served as chair of BLG's National 2SLGBTQ+ Employee Resource Group and, among other initiatives, founded 2SLGBTQ+ Firm Hop Recruitment Initiatives by partnering with 40 law firms across Canada and 2SLGBTQ+ mentorship programs within BLG and with partner firms across the country. Most recently, Lucas co-founded and chaired the Planning Committee for the PRISM Law Conference and co-founded and oversaw the incorporation and formation of the Canadian Association of LGBTQ2S+ Lawyers. Lucas articled and began his commercial real estate practice in the Toronto office of BLG. He continued to build an international commercial real estate practice in the New York office of Weil, Gottschall & Manges, LLP. Outside the law, Lucas builds on a lifelong love of world history as an amateur historian and is an active supporter of the visual and performing arts in Toronto, Montreal, and New York City.
So we have been having the best time chatting with Lucas before we hit record. And I finally just said, okay, we have to hit record. We have to savor all of this goodness. So Lucas, we are so happy you are here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I thought it was a mistake when I got the invitation, but it's delightful to be here.
Definitely not a mistake. So Lucas, we came to know you because when Erin and I were Pro Bono Students Canada coordinators at Windsor Law, we got to see you in action at the annual PBSC training conference, and you are a forever PBSC star, but amongst that, you have had many, many other roles and positions throughout your like really cool career. And so we would love if you could tell us a little bit about how your career has evolved over time.
Well, you know what? I would like to tell myself about it. So let's take a moment to recap. So I went to law school later. I was a mature student, mature in the sense of chronology, if not intellectually or emotionally. I started Osgoode at 31, and I did not really understand the concept of an OCI. It seemed fatuous to me, honestly. Still, if I can be frank, seems utterly fatuous to me to mind New York in that way. But nevertheless, I didn't know what the hell was going on. It did not go well, and I decided, oh, well, I guess I have to actually pay attention to this law school thing, which is too tedious to be imagined. And so I had worked at one of Osgoode's two intensive legal aid clinics, the Community and Legal Aid Services Program, CLASP, which was truly probably the most eye-opening experience of what it actually looked like to do legal work, what being a lawyer actually meant, and also what it looked like to do legal work that was relevant, and an introduction to the real-world policy considerations of access to justice and law. And so I really enjoyed CLASP. And so I worked in that position in between 1L and 2L. In 2L, I joined the board of CLASP and then became the director of Pro Bono Students Canada at Osgoode. At the time, you know, Osgoode is like, I don't know the exact numbers because I know not all schools collect information, but Osgoode is an incredibly diverse school. And I would be comfortable saying, based on my knowledge of at least like the T20 schools in the US and law schools in Canada, easily the most diverse, if not like maybe first or second, like there must be some small quotient of schools which are as diverse as Osgoode. And huge, and it's such a legal market. And we only had a small number of student positions, which I found very frustrating. So it was an opportunity to sort of create a narrative about building new institutions. So you know, we almost doubled the student volunteers. We went from like 87 to 150 something, I think that's what we did. We created double the new partnerships. we worked with U of T. There was a brilliant student who was directing the U of T program, Luca Mariscotti, who was just an absolute delight to work with. So we worked with Luca. So that was really fun. So PPSC went well. And then after, during that summer, I actually secured my articling position through the articling recruit. That's all the secrets with BLG. Through the very formidable Angela Sorti, who was directing professional recruiting at BLG at the time, and now she's with Fasken in a new role. So I sort of closed off law school in a very interesting way, where I come from a political science, political theory background, even more obtuse than political science. So bilingual, political theory, PPSC in CLASP, and yet no government agencies wanted to interview me. I just assumed I would go work at the government, if I can be honest with you. And I just thought, like, who the hell's going to interview me in the corporate world? But it turned out they are much more popular on Bay Street than I was in the government, to my great surprise. So then I went to BLG. BLG is delightful because it's enormous. And I get to do just a bizarre number of things. And then at the same time I was at BLG, I believe that was the last tail end of when I was serving as the national coordinator of PBSC, when I believe you and I would have interacted, Piper, at the time. Yeah. Which I can only imagine how intense I must have sounded at that time, coming off of PBSC and then articling with an amount of Red Bull in my veins, which would have qualified me as like a weapon of mass destruction. But I then went from BLG articling, which was very intense. Like any firm, I think even smaller firms would be more intense than large firms, but you know, it was very intensive. I got hired back at BLG real estate group. That would have been a start date of, August 2019. And then from August 2019 till March, I was a real in-person lawyer. And then we went virtual. So the entire sort of infancy of my legal career past the first 6 months of being an actual associate was virtual, which was a interesting trend. I mean, BLG invested heavily in technology, so it was like very seamless, but still it's a very different environment, as I'm sure you're all aware of through your own experiences. And so that was fun. It was a great experience. I learned a lot. I got really used to my house and my dogs. I got spoiled, honestly, about doing legal work for very long hours without commuting and with having an availability of snacks in my house that were healthy and free. And then, you know, COVID didn't turn down the real estate market. COVID made everything go bananas, right? Like, I think for most firms, God, I'm showing my age now in my COVID memory, but 2020, 2021 were some of the most profitable, if not the most profitable years for many large like firms in Canada and the US. And so they're unlocked that unusual sort of singular war for talent, which characterized the end of the 2021 legal market, beginning the 2022 legal market. And I was contacted by a Canadian lawyer who lives in New York with his wonderful husband, who is a partner, I believe, at Kirkland, Matthew Rosenberg of Lateral Link, very pleasant. And he said, do you think you might be interested in going to New York? And I do real estate law. So as many of you will know, real estate is shockingly parochial and does not usually travel well. We are not securities lawyers. So I was like, I mean, you're nice, but what are you talking about, my friend? Get serious. Like, it's not going to happen. So I thought, what the hell? Like, it's good practice. And then shockingly, like, we prepared my materials. We talked about firms. We identified firms I was interested in. I'm not sure, you're probably both better students and better lawyers than I ever was or am, but I did not know anything about the American legal market. I couldn't have given less of a shit, to be frank. And then I found out that there's some interesting firms. Weil stood out. They really excellent. I work at Weil, Gottschall & Manji. Sorry, Weil's the abbreviation. And I started there in February of 2022, February 1st. Yeah. And then as side projects, should I stop there and talk more about the side projects with all the LGBTQ stuff?
Lucas, you're amazing. Aaron and I are having the best time. Let's dive into some of the side projects in a minute because we have so many questions about what you just said.
Uh-oh. Yeah, there's so much going back there. You have had such a cool career. And I guess just kind of going back, I know you said you went to law school a little bit later in life. What was that moment that led you to kind of change paths and pursue law as a career?
Okay, very good question. It became clear to me, at least in my own experience, that I had been aware theoretically of Canada's focus on credentials and the description of Canada as a credentialist society. But I thought, you know what, like you get work experience, you have life experience, you've lived abroad, like you're going to be able to, you know, get something. But then I soon realized that truly, absent a piece of paper that serves as an acceptable form of proof that you are competent, people do not assume your competence or give you the opportunity to be competent. So I read a description once of a law degree as a certificate of general competence. And I thought, and you know, everyone since my kindergarten teacher had been like, Lucas is argumentative and mouthy, so he should be a lawyer. And I was like, fought against it for many years. And I was like, you know what? Let's go do this. Let's go become lawyers. So I decided to go to law school because I realized that I did want to be involved in the community. I did want to be involved in politics. I did want to be able to make a living. And, you know, Canada cities are very expensive. And I just realized that the path I was on, which was at that point finishing a master's in political theory and then considering law school or a PhD in political theory, it became very clear to me which one was more closely aligned with my lifetime goals of being able to, for example, like buy dinner in Toronto.
Completely, completely understandable. And I think too, not to discredit your experience, but we like to keep it really real about money here on the podcast. And I think too, what a lot of people find nowadays is that, you know, being a lawyer doesn't, like going to law school now doesn't always put you ahead financially in the way that you anticipate. And the amount of student debt that can be accrued from going to law school is enormous, even in Canada. And so I completely agree that you're probably, you know, much better off financially than if you had gone and done that PhD in political thought. Though that sounds very cool. But I completely agree. That's just, you know, it's so interesting when we learn like all of the reasons people went to law school. And you going to law school, Lucas, did so many people a lot of good. And you probably like, you know, but it's true. And it's one of those things that if, you know, if everyone had the opportunity to put all the people that they've ever helped into a room or on a Zoom call, like you definitely, Lucas, would like exceed Zoom's capacity for number of participants.
Come on.
Lucas, we were wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you spearheading the PBSC Trans ID Clinic and Canada's first pro bono tax law clinic came to be.
Oh my goodness. being from Atlantic Canada, what's nice is that we're trained to be what I would describe as like friendly to a sociopathic degree. So like I find people in metropolitan settings, especially in places like law school, take for granted the concentration of excellent people you meet. Like, I mean, truly, like I don't subscribe to the ludicrous view that lawyers are a special breed of people. I mean, or that especially intelligent. I think I got dumber after law school, in all frankness. But I met really like some of the most exceptional people of my life through law school, present company included. And I like to get things done. And when you just are surrounded by brilliant people who have brilliant ideas, it's not hard to be like, okay, like let's do it, right? So especially somewhere like Osgoode in Toronto. Toronto has an enormous amount of resources, enormous amount of people. Osgoode has an enormous amount of resources, enormous amount of people. PBSC is a big organization. So in both of these instances, I worked with really wonderful people at PBSC National. And truly like was for the Trans ID Clinic, helped move it along and was along for the ride and its expansion. And for the tax clinic, happened to connect with a really brilliant Osgoode alum who had this plan. So for the Trans ID Clinic, that was originally proposed and created by Daniel Simonian, who was at the time was the director of the family law program and one of the, I believe, program coordinators is the term. That was our term anyway. Wonderful man, brilliant, still a friend today. And so Daniel proposed this model in collaboration with Sketch in Toronto and Blake's. And so we were able to source really excellent volunteers for the very first clinic from Osgoode. We were very happy to be able to do that. It was very successful. We worked with Daniel on sort of the model and how it was going and the training. And then when I became the national coordinator, we were able to scale that across the country, not by taking the literal example of saying, let's look at how we did in Toronto, but we were able to really bring it to markets, which really surprised me. If I recall, we were able to launch it, I believe, in Windsor, Essex, right? We were actually able to launch it there. I believe we were able to launch it, unless I'm mistaken, in Fredericton, which I mean, Fredericton, the recent census data does show Fredericton's one of the great capitals of gender diversity in the country, along with Halifax, but I wasn't aware of that at the time, right? Very interesting. So we were really pleased. We were able to scale it up. And again, it's because you meet brilliant people, you make a workable plan, and then you work with it. It's not, I mean, I just never shut up. I think if you don't shut up, you get a lot done because you just keep telling other people who are brilliant how to do things. And they're like, great, and they just do it and you get credit. So truly, that's how that worked. For the Tax ID Clinic, I didn't know, again, the Americans are frustrating, right? Because we like to have an opinion of the Americans as being conservative, but in fact, a shockingly innovative society. Turns out that a pro bono tax law clinic is a model well established in the United States. And when we started the one at Osgood, it didn't exist in the country. There wasn't one in Canada. Like there was, you could get help with your tax, but a tax law clinic, which really addresses, I think, those initial scary revenue Canada letters, which apparently most of the time you can really fix with, like someone with basic tax knowledge, which is decidedly not me, may I just qualify, taking a look at those and sort of answering. And so I met Justin Kutyan, who I believe now is the managing partner of KPMG Law, an Osgood grad in Toronto. We went for lunch and he described what he was interested in. And I said, well, PBSC can help you. And I think we can even, I was of course cheating because I was like, we can also house you at CLASP, I think. So then we actually ended up housing it at CLASP. So it was the PBSC KPMG CLASP, I think, tax ID clinic. And it was hosted at CLASP and he was teaching at Osgood. So he could come to CLASP and use their office, I think on Tuesdays. And we had the wonderful director of CLASP at the time, Suzanne Johnson, who a visionary woman. And so she also signed off. It was just a really great opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And yeah, we definitely had the TransID clinic when Piper and I were program coordinators in Windsor, and it was such a great program. And it's just so neat to hear how you guys were able to build that up and get things going and then share it with the rest of us. So that's awesome. So how do you stay involved with pro bono these days?
Do you mean like PBSC directly or pro bono writ large?
Both. Yeah. PBSC, oh. Pro bono work. What are you up to these days? What are
Heaven
you?
Help. Goodness. What am I not up to? No. So, for PBSC, I mean, I am actively involved. Whenever I have an opportunity to support or share or give feedback or support students, I do. I know I'm no longer directly in contact with the PBSC directors at Osgood. But I know, for example, the interim director of PBSC in an endless stream of Osgood CLASP is one of the lawyers who was the family law supervisor at CLASP while I was there, Dana Rotenberg. So she's actually now the interim director of PBSC. So it's a very small world. And I did write to Dana to congratulate her and let her know that I was available if I could be of any assistance. And then, you know, we developed really strong friendships through PBSC. So Nikki Gershbane, the former chief inclusion officer at McCarthy's, Tally Golombek, who's now at the Global Professional Masters of Law program at U of T, and Daniel Simonian, who is now a member of the Immigration and Refugee Board and I believe the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. We talk regularly. We still have a Facebook or like a WhatsApp group, so we still are in touch. And then in terms of the actual work I do, again, I'm working in New York now. A very different model of pro bono in the United States. So like much more inculcated. An expectation of at least 50 hours, a requirement of at least 50 hours. And that's not only from within WILE on a yearly basis, but also to get called to the New York bar, you have to have evidence you've done 50 hours of pro bono, which is very interesting. And then at WILE I'm involved in, there's a lot of really interesting projects. So I'm working on a positive asylum application case for someone who suffered some homophobic violence in another country and looking for refugee status in the United States. And then also on a variety of real estate matters for nonprofits where they require assistance like negotiating their leases and other property related documents.
So Lucas, for anybody listening that might be confused, because I am about to bring up another project that Lucas both spearheaded and works on, Lucas does practice law. Like, in case anyone's just like curious, like he does these things and he's also practicing law at a New York law firm. So just like in case anyone was like, oh, that's so cool that he, you know, lives his life doing all these projects. It's like, no, his full-time job is practicing law, just in case anyone was confused, because I know it might sound confusing. So Lucas, Aaron and I love to learn a bit more about the work you've done to create and build CALL, which to my knowledge stands for the Canadian Association of LGBTQ2S+ Lawyers. And you also ran the inaugural PRISM conference this past June. And we'd love to hear more about this organization and sort of what the long-term and short-term plan is, because it's an amazing organization that really fills like a void that there was in the Canadian legal landscape.
It feels confusing to practice law and do all these things, but in a fun way. I feel confused anyway, might as well be useful on doing it. So this is such a long story. God, I have to shut up sometimes. We founded the firm Hub because we at BLG, the last month of my articling, we had the Western Canadian Firm Hub come through, which is this interesting thing, which I guess for those of you in Western Canada is old news, but it's quite exciting to those of us in Toronto, where Western Canadian schools would organize a day or two of like sequential visits to Toronto law firms for students who were interested in applying to the Toronto formal recruit process. And I thought, well, this is a hell of a model. We should steal this. I mean, I don't have to invent anything new. And so we did. And we figured it would be a great way to sort of connect LGBTQ2S plus students with sort of law firms in Toronto who were interested. Because even someone like Osgood, but I had thought like Osgood was very, very open, very accepting, a large community. There were still these really strange disconnects between like the, I think the genuine efforts of many of the large firms to get people in, and this vision of them as these sort of monoliths of exclusionary WASP culture, which like, sure, there's some of that, there is, but like it just didn't reflect the reality of them like literally like marching in pride parades and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to attempt to retain diverse talent. So I wanted to get people in the door and like connect them. And so we worked under a really brilliant person named Lali Mushiri, who is truly a godsend. And to my knowledge, she was the first person tasked with doing diversity work officially at a law firm in Canada. She was the National Director of Diversity and Inclusion at BLG. So we said to her during our first year, Chloe Richardson and I, can we host a firm hub? So can we get a bunch of firms together and then invite students from across the country and have like a cocktail party? And they said, yes. And so we got some money and we've reached out to Nikki Gershbane. Thank God she was so kind, because we made this up, like we had no idea it would work, and she agreed. And then we reached out to Kim Bonner at Castles, who's also a personal hero. Hi, Kim, love you. And so once we had a few firms involved, we could get like friends at Faskin and then, you know, friends at Osler. People were willing to take a bet on it and see how it worked. We put out the news and the call to different schools, and the firm hop ended up being a really like truly like a very big surprise success. And the first year was fun because we planned it with the Wendy Babcock drag show at Osgood. So it ended with like 50 of us with wonderful drag queens and two cases of Prosecco on a bus to Osgood from DLG. It was magical. And so we kept that running during the pandemic. So that happened in that was in early March 2020. That was the first one in Toronto. And since then we've had them in Montreal, Quebec City, Ottawa, and then Alberta and Vancouver. In fact, the latest one is coming up as we're discussing this shortly in Alberta and Vancouver. And so that was really successful. So we thought that was nice. That was a good. And then from that, we started sort of a mentorship program that ran and fits and starts in different markets in the country. And it just started to expand to the point where, because of BLG's generosity and Lali's vision, we were using BLG essentially as this LGBTQ legal association. And I was like, well, we should probably make a legal box to put this in, because it can't just be at BLG forever. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so we decided to create the Canadian Association of LGBTQ2S Plus Lawyers. It also became necessary because, you know, SOGIC exists in the different provinces, which is the Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Subcommittee of the various CBA chapters. SOGIC does very important work, very important law reform work, very important prizes for the community, has really led the charge in many jurisdictions. But SOGIC's job isn't really a recruitment. It isn't really promotional. It isn't necessarily the same things that we were doing. In fact, we were sort of like filling a void and I think acting in a complementary way to SOGIC. And we also noticed that there was in the USA, similarly, the Lavender Law Conference and the LGBTQ Bar, which existed alongside the SOGI subcommittee of the ABA. So we kind of noticed like we had a similar function as the American system, but we were missing a piece of that apparatus that had been working so well in the South. So essentially we decided to go ahead with it. We met with SOGI, we met with a bunch of people to say like, hey, like we don't want to build anything redundant, right? We just want to make sure we're creating something new that's helping people out. And then we got together with a team of really brilliant, really brilliant lawyers and students from across the country. And then we foolishly, at the same time, designed this Canadian Association of LGBTQ Lawyers with BLG as our pro bono counsel, and then planned and executed our first conference, the PRISM conference, which was sort of based off the Lavender Law model in the United States. For anyone who knows, like the idea of a conference, we made it up. I just want to stress it was really magical because like I'm a very ambitious person, but I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this term, we pulled it out of our ass. Like, it just didn't exist. We just made it up. We were like, well, I guess this is what a conference looks like. Here you go, ding-a-ring, like, let's make it happen. We asked for money, we got sponsors, it was just wild. And it really came together beautifully. And it made a lot of sense to bring that in-house because as some of you may be aware, there was the Start Proud organization, which now under leadership of Trevor Fairley, who was also involved in planning the conference, sort of at the time had launched a legal conference that didn't quite I think the timing didn't work or just didn't quite work out. And we thought, you know, it's unusual that of all the equity seeking groups in the legal community, our community was the one that had outsourced to non-lawyers the planning of this kind of conference, which just didn't seem to make a great deal of sense. We thought, let's just bring this in-house to ourselves, start managing it. And then at that point, we were planning this conference. We had the firm hops, we had the mentorship. It just made sense then. We just needed at that point to bring into existence the Call a Call box, which is a bilingual acronym, sorry, just to clarify, and put everything into that box, which we are still in the process of building up with the board, the rules and membership structure of Call a Call, but it does exist now and everything is under that box.
Yeah, so we will definitely link to your website, Call a Call. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, sorry, all jokes aside, also, if anyone's coming with legal acronyms, I think it's like the Canadian Association of Labor Lawyers. There's like 17 organizations that are CALL. So we tried to find the acronym to be like Call a Call is like somewhat different. Like, yeah.
Okay, excellent. But we will have a link so you can find out more. You can see what's happening in Alberta and Vancouver coming up soon if you want to join. And we will put all the information in the episode notes. But thank you so much for sharing. That sounds amazing. And hey, you know what? If it didn't exist, then you have to pull it out of somewhere, make it your own. So glad to hear that you guys did. Yeah. So we'd love to know a bit more about the transition to working in New York. And if you have any advice for anyone who may be listening and, you know, maybe like you had their ears perked up thinking there's no way that could ever happen. But hey, it happened. So we'd love to hear more about what your transition to the New York market was like.
And I will say also, just to close with the other piece, I have to also say we had just the most amazing help and most amazing people. And my role was to be like a very marginal cheerleader and or Rottweiler when necessary. I just want to stress, like, just to clarify my actual role in these organizations. Thank you. Separately, the transition to New York, we spent a lot of time in New York. Like, I spent a lot of time in New York with my husband. I love New York. Also, like, we joke, like, you know, I'm in Toronto and Montreal. That's where I spent the last like 20 years of my life. I mean, you can see New York down the street. It's right there. It's not like a big deal, right? Very similar legal culture. So easy, right? Like I did big firm to big firm. I also cheated a bit, right? Like Weil is known for its excellent culture. Like it really is famous actually for like the quality of its culture and its focus on accountable, non-abusive partners, which I sadly think is a remarkable achievement across many law firms still in 2023. So my transition was easy in that I really work truly like with excellent, excellent people who are like, and this is not hyperbolic, at the very apogee of their practice on the planet, like the very best people at their job on earth, not in New York, like on the planet, and they're kind. It's hard not to admire someone who is really like one of the best, if not the best commercial real estate lawyer in the world, who is also very kind and generous and patient. Like it wasn't a taxing transition. So I'm hesitant to generalize my experience because it was very pleasant. I think unusually pleasant. And I'm not sure reflective of the general fact that like New York is New York. It's not Sesame Street. Like I've heard horror stories of firms, like just like I've heard about in every market in Canada. So please just, I want to qualify my adventure. My transition was very lovely. They were very kind. It started virtually, so I moved to New York on January 28th of 2022. Very lovely. We started on Feb 1. They got me involved. Lots of mentorship. Very developed, shockingly well-developed mentorship programs in the U.S. Really intensive, thoughtful. I did not find like admittedly, like, I mean, I did leave the Toronto practice during probably what was probably one of the busiest times for associates in the last 20 years. I did not find the number of hours different. Like, I know that that's not a popular thing to say. I did not find the number of hours different. I will say that New York is very kind. The one difference is that because of the difference in the price point, which, I mean, you're charging multiples what you would charge in Toronto. And if you're at one of these very large, like, you know, top 20 firms like Weil, like, you are a luxury product. So, like, when a customer walks into Louis Vuitton and asks for something and they're very demanding, they do it because the customer's paying $15,000 for a wallet or whatever. I've not been in a Louis Vuitton store in 20 years. Same thing with Weil. Like, if a client needs something for a multi-billion-dollar deal and it means that you need to stay up for 2 days, then, I mean, no one is being rude, but it is what it is. Like, that's what you signed up for. You have to do it. So I would say that the difference is not, I don't think, a greater number of hours, at least in my experience so far. The difference is that there are no guardrails. Like, when things are urgent, like, the quote that I have from New York is that you will walk through walls for clients. That is an actual quote that I heard. Your job is to walk through walls for clients. And sometimes it feels like you are walking through walls for clients.
And so, Lucas, in this environment, how do you take care of your mental health?
Oh, my goodness. Again, I'm a very bad example. Something happened in my brain chemistry as a young child where I'm just too happy. I don't know what to, I don't know what happened.
It's because you're from New Brunswick. That could possibly be it.
It could be just, yeah, like that and like a lot of Mega Man. I don't know. I'm always in a good mood. For me, it was goal oriented. Like, I really wanted to get a new experience at this very complex level. So that made me feel good. And then also, in all frankness, like, and this is a broader discussion, which we can touch on, you know, all of our modern firms are based on the Cravath model as articulated, I think, at the end of the 19th century, Cravath being, of course, the eponymous New York firm. And New York is where this model comes from. So it's obvious when you go to the market that has the kind of capital markets that can support the fees that support this structure, that the structure works optimally because that's the market it was developed for. So, you know, it's easier to work wild hours when you're being paid. In all frankness, I mean, the scale for a fourth year call in New York is right now with exchange, like $406,000 as base pay. Your base pay is 406. Like,
I'm so sorry. I just like need a moment. That is,
my brain can't compute.
Can you repeat that number?
Yeah. So like right now, the base pay for a fourth year call, unless I'm mistaken, is $295,000. So with exchange right now, it's like $405,000-$406,000.
I've made so many terrible mistakes in my life.
And then your bonus, I believe, is something around 75,000 American. So really it's 100,000. So your fourth year call and your bonus and salary is in the range of $500,000 as a fourth year call.
I am unwell.
So I just mean in Toronto, like, and whatever, like, in Toronto, like, there's excellent pay in Toronto, but like New York just cannot be matched because that, like, it's their model. I think long-term, truly, like, I wouldn't mind running a law firm because I think we have to really stop like the backwater mindset of just thinking we need to mime Cravath. I think a law firm in Canada could operate from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., pay a reasonable rate, but offer people time off, would retain top-tier talent that New York couldn't steal because it would offer work-life balance. But no one's gone there yet. But I think that's where the future is.
Yeah, wow.
We should be honest. I agree with your position too, but honest with money. I think that one of the ways currently, especially with the shocking inequality that's growing in our own society, I really like the Norwegian model, I believe, where everyone's income from the income tax is available online. Because I think the best disinfectant is light. So we should not be shy about it. We should be very clear about who's getting paid, how much to do what, and what it means. So also when people apply to jobs in New York, as in my case, it wasn't because I was like greedy. It's because I had spent a lot of money and accumulated a great deal of debt. And the most realistic way to pay that off in my extant lifetime was to work in Manhattan.
No, 100%. And I think too, like, I was having a conversation with someone yesterday and talking about, and I've probably said this on the podcast before, about how like something I've learned is I want everyone I know to make a lot of money. And the reason is not to be greedy, as you've described. And, you know, maybe I need to finesse that sentence a bit more, but money leads to like freedom. Money leads to like progressive power. And so what I mean by that is, like, Lucas, when you talk about leading a law firm and like changing culture and starting, you know, starting a law firm that, you know, works 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., like things like that take positional power, which is like often comes from having money. And so when we want to see good people do good things, we want those good people to make money in order to be able to do the good things. So, you know, I joked earlier about, oh, to anyone listening, like, just if you're confused, Lucas does practice law and then does all these other good things. And so you're out here working and making a ton of money, which, congratulations, like, I think that's wonderful and not a bad thing at all and not a thing to shy away from. But also that positional power allows you to give back. I mean, not everyone does, to be clear, like, but it gives you power to give back to all of these amazing organizations. And I think that that's really wonderful.
I mean, I appreciate your view, because I'm not sure Oscar was very good. A lot of lovely people who went to school and just everywhere in life, people post a lot on social media. They post the right thing. They say the right thing. But when they actually get to a position where they have like structural power, it's amazing how many people just don't use it. You're like it is a vital, if you have access to structural power, I would go so far as to say you have a moral imperative. And especially if you're a lawyer, I am amazed people gloss over like the rules of professional conduct and the oath you take. Because it like, surely you must remember that you have your duty is to increase like the quality of the adjudication and administration of justice in our society, in a plural society, and also to increase access to justice, which I do not understand why people do not take that seriously, because that literally keeps me up at night sometimes, those two requirements, because I think of how to balance that with commercial practice.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like that. I don't know if groupthink is the right word, or just when you become like socialized, like you come in and you're like, okay, yeah, like I'm sure everyone wrote really nice cover letters to get into law school about how they want to change the world and shit. And then, you know, you get socialized into, you know, going through the one track, as we always talk about. And then it's really easy to lose sight of why you wanted to go to law school in the first place and that oath that you took, and just, you know, focus on your own personal life track and everything. But it's really nice to see that, you know, you can still have some balance and, you know, work on paying off your debt and work on creating a future for yourself, but also give back and contribute in so many other different ways. So thank you so much for showing us.
Yep. You guys are so nice. I will say one thing I always think about is that people, we think that like people want good to prevail, but I don't think people think about the mechanics of a good prevails. Good doesn't prevail because they're nice. It prevails because people who are good are more frightening and effective than the people who are bad. And so part of what I think about commercial practice is, for those of you listening who are considering it, it will make you a more frightening person. It will make you what the Prussians wished they were at the height of themselves. Like, you will become a more frightening person, but you can then bring that frightening self to bear for people who justly deserve that kind of zealous advocacy outside of a commercial context. So think about it.
That is good food for thought. So Lucas, we would love to know what one of your favorite memories or proudest moments of your career has been.
Oh, stop. Oh my goodness. Am I allowed to talk about like my extracurricular stuff? Is that permitted?
Whatever. Yeah, whatever.
I'll say one thing. Mentoring people has been really, really, really lovely. Because they're really exceptional people, and I've really had to be like, oh, just all I do is essentially tell them they're exceptional, and then they realize they're exceptional, and then they flourish, and I'm like, yay, I'm a genius. So that's been really great, because that's like self-cleaning ovens. But otherwise, truly, at the first PRISM conference, when it came together, we were thrilled, right? Because it wasn't just that it came out of, to contextualize, we planned that for a year during COVID. And then it was like the first major conference any of us had attended, or first major event any of us had attended in years. So we literally had it in June of 2022. So I had not been in a room with that many people, save for an airport, in the better part of 2.5 years. Like, it was really like a big event. And so it was a great success. And we organized a surprise, because we thought one of the things we would do by taking the conference in-house is make awards for our own community as well. And we wanted to make an award to recognize someone like Lale, who had who was not a member of the community, but who had like put so much of their personal reputation and interest and engagement into helping the community. Like BLG's like trans inclusion strategy, very advanced, like very important from day one. BLG's new offices in Toronto, gender inclusive washrooms, like really big issue for Lale. If I'm not mistaken, like a gender affirmation surgery, I believe under Lale also became included in the healthcare package. And then she gave us the leeway to build what we build without any ego or territory, right? Like she was just happy for us to do it. So really like everything that we did was truly like PRISM and the call conference or the call entity could not have existed except for Lale. So everyone else was necessary but not sufficient, but Lale alone was absolutely sufficient. Like Lale was the one we needed. I'm sorry, I just missed that, but it's been years since the LSAT. So Lale was amazing, and we made an award for her. We named an annual award after her called the Lale Moshiri Ally Award, which recognizes a member of the community who's an ally, who has made a sustained structural impact in the advancement of rights for our community. And she didn't know, she was in the room. So we got up on stage and announced the creation of the award and gave it to her, much to her surprise, in front of a room full of people whose lives she had made better. That was like the proudest moment of my career, because I was able to not give recognition to someone who was a rising star or someone who was generating profits for a random corporation, but to actually recognize someone who had done the structural work to improve the lives of others to no benefit to herself, and to make her a permanent part of the legacy of an organization that she is justly a permanent part of its legacy, right? Like she's just an important person. And so being able to recognize like a mentor and a friend, and to create a permanent way to recognize that kind of allyship, truly, like honestly, it almost made me cry. I get really red when I cry, and there was camera, so I couldn't, but you know, otherwise it was real close. Yeah.
Lucas, that is so heartwarming. Oh my God.
Okay, that was exactly what I was going to say, Piper. Sorry, I was going to say it was very heartwarming too.
No, it felt heartwarming. So like, she's so lovely.
Oh, Lucas, that's so wonderful. So you have told us so many incredibly energizing and engaging and happy stories today. And we always love to end the podcast with the same question. And sometimes it's like a bit of a, like, gets people a little stumped. But I don't think it will be the case necessarily here, because I feel like you're just constantly doing things. So what is something new that you've learned recently?
Something new that I learned recently?
Yeah.
Yeah. It could be anything. It doesn't have to be law related.
Oh my God. Endless. Please, Jesus. My whole life is me being constantly reminded of my own perpetual ignorance and all things. I was very interested to learn about the, I have a very, as many of you will know, who know me, sadly, because I never showed up about it. I love history. And I love ancient history. And I'm always interested. In the study of the Inca, I first realized the importance of like astrology and to like ancient civilizations, because I guess we forget because we don't see them. But of course, for ancient civilizations, like to make sense of many symbols, of many calculations, of the placement of many structures, you have to look back at archaeology. So it was interesting for me to learn about the concept of precession, which is, I guess, because of the Earth's tilt, I guess, the gradual changing place of stars in the night sky from the same general geographic area, and sort of the fact that an interesting way to hypothesize the orientation or purpose of temples is to track, you can actually go back in time using a reverse precession model and find out where stars would have been and line them up with certain lines to see if your hypothesis about what star they were oriented towards makes sense.
Okay, cool. That is something I knew nothing about. I'm looking at Erin and getting the sense that she also knew nothing about that. And that's why we ask those questions, because we want to continue to learn new things. And everyone we've ever had on the podcast has always taught us something new. So this was awesome. Lucas, thank you so much for being here and for sharing like your energy and your time and your experiences with us. It was so enriching for us. And I know it has been very enriching to everyone listening. And we are so grateful that you came on Off the Tracks.
Thank you for having me. Hope we don't get any trouble.
Thanks for joining. joining us for this episode. To stay up to date with the podcast, follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite listening platform for a brand new episode of Off the Tracks Podcast every Tuesday.